Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show, looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. An article from the Huffington Post by Dan Strumpf and Tom Krischer, GM. Lack of subprime lending is holding back sales. If your credit isn't good, General Motors still wants to sell you a car. The problem is, it can't, at least not in big numbers. That's why the automaker wants more control over its lending again. GM's top North American executive, Mark Roos, under pressure to quickly sell more cars and boost GM's value, as it gets ready to sell stock to the public, said a shortage of subprime lending is holding back sales in the U.S. But the automaker's main lender, Ally Financial Inc., has little appetite for risky loans, having spent the last few years cleaning up its own financial mess, caused mainly by its failing mortgage lending business. Both companies are majority owned by the U.S. government. For decades, GM owned Ally, writing its own loans through the so-called captive finance arm. Nearly every automaker makes loans in such a fashion. But a cash-starved GM sold most of Ally, formerly known as GMAC, in 2006. GM and Ally now have a loose partnership that gives Ally control over who gets a car loan. If GM returned to auto lending, either through buying Ally's auto business or starting its own in-house lending unit, it could set lending standards itself. That could benefit the automaker by allowing it to extend loans to people with weaker credit and to more lease customers. There's a real sense of urgency on GM's part to maximize its sales as it gets closer to the stock offering, said Kirk Lutke, Senior Vice President of CRT Capital Group in Stanford, Connecticut. Subprime buyers make up a significant portion of the car buying market. About 16% of all new vehicle loans written in the fourth quarter of 2009 were to customers with below prime credit, according to credit agency Experian. That means they went to customers with credit scores below 620 on a 300 to 850 point scale. Roos, president of GM North America, would not say outright if the automaker was looking to set up its own financing operation, but he said last week that one need only to look at auto loan data to find plenty of good reasons for GM to have control of its own financing. For example, Honda Motor Company gets 20% of its sales and leases from subprime buyers, he said. GM, on the other hand, gets only 1% because it can't access the money to loan to those customers. They're able to finance their cars at a much lower level than we are, Roos said. I'm not sure what the answer is, but it would sure help my sales, the company sales in North America, if we were able to get access. During the recession, lending to subprime customers tumbled as the credit markets froze and delinquencies spiked. Leasing also ground to a halt as the resale values of cars plunged. Ally has been less than eager to resume lending to risky customers. After GM sold a majority stake in Ally, the lender became heavily involved in the subprime mortgage boom, a move that nearly bankrupted the company when the housing market collapsed. Ultimately, the federal government has spent $16.3 billion to bail out the lender, leaving taxpayers with a 56% stake in the former GMAC. Ally has spent the last year trying to clean up its mess, diversifying its customer base beyond just GM buyers, launching a highly profitable online banking service, and working to sell what remains of its mortgage lending business. Earlier in May, the company posted its first quarterly profit in more than a year and rebranded itself as Ally. Subprime lending for cars is generally considered less risky than mortgages. During the recession, borrowers didn't default on car loans as much as they did on homes because the value of cars never became overinflated. Also, if a car buyer defaults, the lender can quickly repossess the vehicle and resell it, recouping at least part of the lender's investment. Ally would appear to have little to gain, though, from selling its auto lending operation, by far its most profitable line of business. Riding auto loans made Ally $846 million in pre-tax profit in the first quarter, the division's fifth straight quarterly profit, up 28% from a year earlier. Competition from a new GM-owned lender also would be tough. In the first quarter, Ally wrote 34% of all loans to GM buyers, a figure that has been rising over the last year. It handled 88% of the loans that finance GM dealers' inventory. An additional complication comes from Chrysler Group LLC, which also depends on Ally for loans. CEO Sergio Marchionne told reporters last week that Chrysler could be at a disadvantage if GM buys back part of Ally. If they control the lending practices and the degree of penetration and support that they gave to Chrysler, that would make us very, very concerned, he said. In the end, any decision is likely to be influenced by the Treasury Department, which designated Ally the preferred lender for Chrysler as well as GM, and owns big stakes in all three after bailing them out last year. Ally, for its part, issued a statement last week saying the company is committed to staying in the auto lending business. Ally spokeswoman Gina Proia declined to comment on whether the lender has faced pressure from GM to make more subprime loans or leases. However, she said that as the economy has improved, Ally has been opening its pockets to more customers. For example, 12% of all auto loans that Ally wrote in the first quarter were leases, up from 4% in the fourth quarter and virtually zero last year, she said. As the financial crisis has eased and as the credit markets come back, we have been able to broaden our offerings and look at the credit spectrum more broadly, Proia said. The company does not disclose the percentage of loans it makes to subprime customers, she said. GM's Roos said Ally has been a good partner and has given the automaker everything it has asked for, including a recent 24-month lease deal. Ally also has been helpful in targeting competitors or regions with loans. He said GM hasn't asked Ally about expanding subprime lending, and he said the two companies might be able to work out a deal. They do a good job, but clearly there's some opportunities there too, he said. And another interesting story from the Huffington Post by Arthur Delaney. K Street protest. Dozens storm DC bank branches, block K Street intersection. Dozens of noisy, purple-shirted SEIU, Service Employees International Union, protesters stormed a Bank of America branch near the U.S. Capitol last week, forcing the bank to close down as confused customers looked on and tellers retreated to an interior room. Other groups from SEIU and National People's Action were set to stage protests at Bank of America's and J.P. Morgan's Chase lobby shops downtown as part of a day-long anti-K Street extravaganza. A security guard told the Huffington Post the branch would be closed only temporarily. From there, the group blocked an intersection in D.C.'s tiny Chinatown, then stopped by a Citibank branch. Corporate greed has got to go, they yelled. At 11 a.m., hundreds of protesters from SEIU and National People's Action merged at the offices of Democratic super lobbyist Tony Podesta, who boasts Bank of America among his massive client list. "We're fired up to take down Wall Street," they chanted. SEIU member Al Marshall traveled from Oakland, California, where he works as a construction inspector, to join the protest. He said he'd recently lost his home to foreclosure after Wells Fargo denied him a modification. He said he struggled to make payments after his wife lost her job and his hours were reduced. I explained to Wells Fargo what the hardship was, and they laughed at me, he said, tears streaming down his face. If the financial industry can spend $1.4 million a day lobbying, there shouldn't be a homeless person anywhere in America. In response, Wells Fargo touted its modification efforts, saying the bank has granted borrowers 505,059 mortgage modifications since the beginning of 2009. According to the latest report from the Treasury Department released Monday, Wells Fargo has modified 25% of eligible delinquent mortgages in its portfolio under the Obama administration's Home Affordable Modification Program, a total of 36,094 permanent modifications. Podesta donates a lot of money to Democratic candidates and party committees, $394,800 in the current election cycle alone, while his firm has booked record revenue lobbying for clients opposed to various parts of the Democratic agenda. Podesta and his firm did not immediately respond to interview requests. By targeting Dem lobbyists like Podesta and Steve Elmendorf, the SEIU and other groups are signaling that they've lost patience with people who appear to be playing both sides. Whether you're an in-house lobbyist or whether you're a hired lobbyist, you're part of this machine backed by millions of dollars dedicated to using a variety of tricks and maneuvers to gut and weaken whatever Congress is trying to change, said SEIU's Stephen Lerner. We want the bank lobbyists to look people directly in the eye. The SEIU estimated that it had 2,000 people on hand when it clogged a K Street intersection for 20 minutes at the height of the protest. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And now we step into the second segment of the show, where we will be continuing our discourse on the two-income trap, why middle-class parents are going broke, which is a breakthrough book that provides solutions to the biggest crisis families face today. And it's authored by Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tyaki. And the thoughts, ideas, examples, and the quotes used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyaki, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. You can also go and revisit and listen to all of the Life and Debt shows at the archives, www.kruufm.com, and look under Life and Debt. And you can catch up on all of the knowledge and information we have been sharing for over 2 years now on dealing with debt. Now, just a little review of last week. We were talking about the cost of subprime mortgages and how people continue to mortgage their future. To give a sense of just how expensive subprime mortgages have been, we consider that in 2001, when standard mortgage loans were in the 6.5% interest rate, Citibank's average mortgage rate, which included both subprime and traditional mortgages, was 15.6%. That includes both of them. To put that in perspective, a family buying a $175,000 home with a subprime loan at 15.6% would pay an extra $420,000 during the 30-year life of the mortgage, which is $420,000 over and above the payments due on a prime rate mortgage. So that is massive. Had the family gotten a traditional mortgage instead, they would have been able to put two children through college, purchase half a dozen new cars, and put aside enough for a considerable, comfortable retirement. Now, Citibank and other subprime lenders typically defend their business practices by arguing that they are helping more families own their homes, but this is little more than really a public relations hot air balloon. In the overwhelming majority of cases, subprime lenders prey on families that already own their homes rather than expanding access to new homeowners. And this is really one of the media hypes that we've been getting now for several years. And whenever I talk to people, they always tell me this if they're not really understanding the entire foreclosure problem. They're saying that these people should be losing their homes because they really couldn't afford them in the first place. Well, fully 80% of subprime mortgages involve refinancing loans for families that already own their homes. That's a fact. For these families, subprime lending does nothing more than increase the family's housing costs, taking away resources from other investments and increasing the chances that the family will lose its home if anything goes wrong, which we've seen now it has in the last 2-3 years. Everything has gone wrong for these people. It's a highly pernicious situation. In effect, it ensnares people who, in a regulated market, would have had access to low-cost mortgages, or lower-cost mortgages, at least. Lenders, their own data, when Professor Warren looked at it, showed that many of the families that end up in the subprime market are really middle-class families that would typically qualify for a traditional mortgage. In other words, they could have gotten the prime mortgage, but were steered away from that to these other mortgages when they were refinancing the house. At Citibank, for example, researchers concluded that at least 40% of those who were sold ruinous subprime mortgages would have qualified for prime rate loans. 40%. And Citibank is not an isolated case. A study by the Department of Housing and Urban Development revealed that 1 in 9 middle-class families and 1 in 14 upper-income families who refinanced a home mortgage ended up with a high fee, high interest rate, subprime mortgage. And a lot of this data is going back before the major bust, which happened several years ago. This book was written before that time. So these numbers are actually much lower than what we've seen in the last 3, 4, 5 years when the subprime boom was hitting the sky. For many of these families that got involved in this, that we're still reading about today, there is no trade-off between access to credit and cost of credit. They had their pockets picked, and that's plain and simple. But you may ask, why would a middle-class family take a high-interest mortgage if they could qualify for better deals? Seems like a simple and straightforward question. But the answer is, they didn't know that they could do any better. Marketing. It's really a matter of marketing and the fact that the media advertisement essentially directed people into thinking this is all they could get. Many unsuspecting families were steered to an overpriced mortgage by a broker or some other middle person who represents himself as acting in the borrower's best interest, but who is actually taking big fees and commissions from subprime lenders. That's what has happened. In some neighborhoods, those brokers go door to door, acting as bird dogs for lenders, looking for unsuspecting homeowners who might be tempted by the promise of extra cash for whatever internal purposes the family may feel they need cash for. Other families got broadsided by extra fees and hidden costs that didn't show up until it was too late to go to another lender. An industry expert described the phenomenon as Mr. Jones negotiates an 8% loan and the paperwork comes in at 10%. And the loan officer or the broker says, don't worry, I'll take care of that, just sign here. And what I see as a bankruptcy attorney is that most people don't even get the opportunity to read, no less understand, the massive amounts of paperwork that is presented to them at the closing. And almost exclusively in this refinancing scenario, there is not an attorney to represent the refinancing homeowner. The broker actually acts in a completely improper way as if they were the ally of the homeowner. This is simply untrue and unethical. Professor Warren points out that every now and then a case comes to the forefront that is particularly egregious, and we've seen lots of these days in the newspapers. Some are just unbelievable. Her example with Citibank was caught in one of the cases where, in 2002, its subprime lending subsidiary was prosecuted for deceptive marketing practices, and the company paid $240 million to settle the case. At the time, that was the largest settlement of its kind. A former loan officer testified how she marketed the mortgages. In a nutshell, if someone appeared uneducated, inarticulate, was a minority, or was particularly old or young, I would try to include all the additional costs City Financial offered. In other words, lending agents routinely steered families to higher cost loans whenever they thought there was a chance they could get away with it. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, again, we're seeing the aftermath of all of this deception, and we're hearing about how all these modifications are taking place. But I know for a fact that the modifications that are being offered, even these five-year modifications, are really just back-ending the amount of arrearages to the mortgage. And frankly, most people will never be able to catch up unless there was some miraculous change in their income. It's really, even at that level, coming from the highest backing of government, a factual deception. It is making it seem like people are really getting a break, but in truth, they are not. But as this was all developing, the steering hit the minority homeowners with particular force. Several researchers showed that the minority families were more likely than white families to get stuck with subprime mortgages, even when the data are controlled for income and credit rating. In other words, the minority could have better income and a higher credit rating and still got duped. According to one study, African-American borrowers are 450% more likely than whites to end up with a subprime instead of a prime mortgage during this mortgage frenzy. In fact, residents in high-income, predominantly black neighborhoods are actually more likely to get a subprime mortgage than residents in low-income white neighborhoods, more than twice as likely according to the data. In many cases, these lenders don't just want families' money, they also want to take the people's homes. That sounds hard to believe, but that was part of the plot. Banks have been caught deliberately issuing mortgages to families that could not afford them, with the ultimate aim of foreclosing on these homes. This practice became so common, it had its own name in the lending industry. Loan to own. What the lenders found was that foreclosing can be more profitable than just simply collecting a mortgage payment every month, because the property can then be resold for more than the outstanding loan amount, particularly when this was a refinance with adjustable rates and all of the equity then may still be in the house, but the homeowner can no longer afford to pay the mortgage. That's just one scenario. The lender rakes in fees at closing and high monthly payments for a few years, then waits for the family to fall behind and sweeps in to take the property. In that setup, the lender wins in every possible way. High profit if the family manages to make all its payments, and higher profits if the family does not. And then there's also the added reality that many, if not most, of these loans were sold off, and the lender just continues to act as a servicer, still raking in all of the fees, where the purchaser investor down line is getting the brunt of the foreclosure if there is not very much equity left, or if the property has to sit for a long time and there's loss, like in Iowa, where it could take 6, 8 months or a year for the lender actually to get the property back after the foreclosure. So this was all a preconceived scheme to get higher profits from innocent people. It isn't the idea that people were being greedy and stupid and just wanted homes which were way beyond their means. the data shows some very, very clear indications that there was a lot of equity out there in homes that the lenders wanted to get their talons into. And as we have seen, they have. At the turn of the century, when there was two decades of mortgage deregulation, the homeowners were 3.5 times more likely to lose their homes in foreclosure than their counterparts a generation before that. And today, it's even worse. Today, we're looking at over 300,000 foreclosures being filed every month. So going back to the beginning of the century here, that the low interest rates and rising home prices should have translated into a falling rate of home foreclosures, not a rising one that we saw then. And Professor Warren points out that the lending industry just ran amok. The rise in loan-to-own lending, the disappearance of the down payment, the explosion in higher interest subprime refinances took their toll as a growing number of families learned the painful consequences of getting trapped by the mortgage industry that has been allowed to make up its own rules. And that's how family spending was transformed in a single generation. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, consumer lending was deregulated, launching a complicated, potentially dangerous product on an unsuspecting public. The timing could not have been worse. Just as corporations were downsizing across America, just when a bidding war for decent family housing was heating up, and just when families lost the all-purpose safety net once provided by the stay-at-home mother, easy credit flooded in, looking just like a life raft to the family that was drowning. But where is the money? Professor Warren points out the question, why do you rob banks? That was posed to Willie Sutton, the famed bank robber of the 1940s. He replied, because that's where the money is. And that's how most businesses work. They make profits by dealing with customers who have money. And that is how the lending industry used to work. Companies made loans to people who had the money or would soon have the money to repay them. Much has been made about the changing nature of America's debtors. Americans don't have the same work ethic that they once did. People don't work hard to pay their bills as they once did, and on. These are the things that we hear. Elizabeth Warren's elderly father agreed with that, telling her quiet stories of destitute families that labored for years to pay bills they had run up during the Great Depression. And I personally knew a family just like that. But she was saying how her father used to talk about Herring Hardware, a farm supply store that her grandfather had run in rural Oklahoma back in 1904. When the Dust Bowl hit in the 1930s and the families could no longer scratch a living out of their modest farms, many packed up and headed west, an exodus etched in the national memory by John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, which you should read sometime. It'll be an interesting parallel to what's going on in America today. Some of those families never forgot the debts they left behind, and 20 years later, Elizabeth Warren's grandfather would still get an occasional envelope with a few $20 bills and a handwritten note. Grant, we finally got ahead a little. Put this on my account and let me know if I owe you more. Eileen sends her best to Ethel. My father leaned back at the end of one of those stories and remarked that these were good people. Good people who followed through on what they owed. Then he would pause and draw his mouth in a hard line. Folks just aren't like that anymore. But one thing Elizabeth Warren's father and most people don't look at anymore is that borrowers aren't the only ones that have changed today. And we will continue with this saga next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Fliptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.